collaborated with the Communist Party or the fascists, and they chose the fascists. Liberals make bad choices. I'm just saying. So trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed the strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power because they were not interested in collaboration with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party just capitulated, saying, well, here, you got power. So Mussolini's now in power. He's set to rebuild the Roman Empire to restore national pride. So what does he do? Well, he already has Libya, so he invades Ethiopia. Now, we have to pay attention to the brutality of Italian colonialism because one of the big myths about Italian fascism is that it was more benign and not as racist as, say, the Nazis. The fascists did come to see themselves as a race, right? A Mediterranean version of Aryans. And while they did not organize Jewish death camps to that degree, they practiced fascist violence in the colonies. But even before the fascists, and this is the most important thing I really want you to take away with this, before the fascists came to power, right, Italy, like all imperial countries, waged a brutal genocidal war in the colonies. So during the Italo-Turkish War in 1911, Italy colonized Libya, which had been a part of the Ottoman Empire. Under the Liberal Party, so it's under the Liberal Party that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population. In 1935, jump forward, the Italian military used mustard gas on Ethiopians in violation of Geneva protocols of 1925, which banned its use, killed 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, and by some estimates, one-third died from chemical weapons. And this may sound familiar, they bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. They massacred prisoners, Italy's occupation of Ethiopia lasted until 1943, and Italy did not formally recognize Ethiopia's sovereignty until 1947. But the biggest issue to me is that the Western countries were very quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, when other Western powers entered, the war against Italy. They still didn't really address war crimes. Soviets initially said nothing before the League of Nations, in part because they were selling coal and oil to Italy. So technically, and this is an argument that I make all the time, I've been making it for 30 years, World War II begins on African soil.
You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
World War II begins on African soil. It begins in Ethiopia. That is the beginning. That is the front. From there, Italian troops attack British colonies in Somalia, in Egypt, Sudan, Kenya, like around 1940. Okay, so African Americans immediately mobilized in defense of Ethiopia, raising money for relief and medical aid. Black communists in Harlem, especially with the help of some Garveyites, created the Provisional Committee for the Defense of Ethiopia. Black men from across the nation volunteered to fight. The Pan-African Reconstruction Association recruited 1,000 volunteers in New York, 1,500 in Philadelphia, 8,000 in Chicago, 5,000 in Detroit, 2,000 in Kansas City. The Garveyite Black Legion established a training camp in upstate New York for some 3,000 volunteers, and they were ready to fight. They were ready to go to Ethiopia to fight, right, to defend Haile Selassie. And that's another complicated thing. But Selassie was pressured by the U.S. to refuse these volunteers, and only two African-American combatants ever reached Ethiopia, and both were pilots. So the first location in Europe, though, where the war began was Spain. So in 1936, when Franco led a military campaign to overthrow the Republican government in Spain, the Loyalists, right, consisting of a popular front government of socialists, communists, anarchists and liberals, they were attacked by Franco, and Franco's armies were supported by what? German planes and Italian planes. Germany and Italy provided arms, supplies, and aerial attack squads. The so-called Western democracies claimed neutrality, even as American corporations like Texaco, Texas Oil Company, extended credit to Franco's forces. Only the Soviet Union and Mexico came to the aid of the loyalists. And this is interesting when you think about it because, you know, again, I'm trying to think about where we are now and what does it mean to back a violent genocidal war, right, with resources, and no one comes to the aid of those who are being killed except for those who volunteer. So the loyalists appeal to volunteers who came from all over the world. And you may know the story. 3,000 people from the United States came to fight or participate in the war in Spain. 90 were African-American. One black woman, Celera Key, served as a nurse. Crawford Morgan, originally from North Carolina, spoke for nearly all black volunteers when he linked the events in Ethiopia with fascist tendencies. In the U.S., mainly, he argued, Negroes have been getting lynched in this country by mobs. So he says, this is what fascist tendencies look like. Vaughn Love, another volunteer, had collected medical supplies for Hands Off Ethiopia, and then he fought in Spain, defined fascism as, quote, the enemy of all black aspirations. So what I'm saying here is that we date the beginning of World War II in Europe to 1939, when it really begins in 1935 in Africa. When fascists invade Ethiopia, Western capitalist nations didn't care because it was Africa. When fascists backed the civil war in Spain to overthrow an elected government, the Western capitalist nations didn't care because they're communists and socialists. All the while, fascists are doing business with U.S. companies and their forces are getting stronger. In other words, they're strengthening, U.S. capital is strengthening fascism in Germany and Italy this whole period. And then they're going to turn around and fight them. Now, if we turn to like Crawford Morgan and Vaughn Love and Langston Hughes about fascism in the South, it's an interesting kind of story. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the fact that Nazis drew directly on American eugenicist ideas about the purity of blood and Aryan superiority. They know that the Nuremberg laws, for example, were modeled after U.S. Jim Crow laws. And we know that, and that's interesting. But see, to me, that part's not surprising. Of course, the U.S. is the basis, the roots of so much racism. I know, I live here, you know. But to me, the main story is something else. First, that these models were not just building blocks for German fascism, but they were evidence of existing fascism in the U.S. South. Violence was the primary mode of governance, and much of the violence was outsourced, which is the roots of slave patrols, you know? And before that, I just learned. The system of law enforcement, and when I say law enforcement, let's read it as property protection, depended on deputizing every white man. The state didn't have to take responsibility for the violent subjugation of its black population when you have a few million Daniel Pennies and Kyle Rittenhouses ready to do it. The South was a one-party dictatorship under which white property ruled. And that white property rule in the South extended to the nation. Let me explain. So by denying black people the vote, Southern congressmen enjoyed a concentration of power. They chaired 29 of the 47 committees in the House, 13 of 33 committees in the Senate, and these were all the most powerful committees: judiciary, agriculture, appropriations, banking and currency, commerce, finance, military affairs, ways and means. And besides counting black people who could not vote for congressional representation, poll taxes made it impossible for even some poor whites to vote. So voter turnout in southern states was like 20% or lower, right, of eligible voters. And not because people didn't want to go vote. right? And so they end up getting the most powerful legislators in Congress and Senate, who then have seniority because they keep being voted in. A white property dictatorship in the South explains why there was no federal anti-lynching bill passed under Roosevelt. In fact, do you know when the federal anti-lynching bill was passed? Thank you, 2022. They also insisted on local control of all New Deal agencies to ensure unequal wages, payments, and maintain segregation. So this is the Faustian bargain that Roosevelt made. Complete suppression of democracy in the South in exchange for support for the New Deal. So don't keep saying that the New Deal is the greatest thing that's ever happened, and we need to go back to that. You know, I understand the loss of the welfare state, but we have to be serious about the history and how that happened and who lost. But the key point here is that fascism persisted in the U.S., it persisted in South Africa, it persisted in many colonies after Second World War. The Second World War did not end fascism. In fact, it expanded. Claudia Jones, in a brilliant essay published in 1946, suggests that the danger of fascism is not over in 1946, but alive and well in the South. And she writes, "Today, the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy of the Black Belt." And she goes on to talk about what I don't have time to talk about, is this a wave of lynchings and killings of Black veterans in particular, right up from 1945, 46, 47, throughout. And we know what happens after that in terms of Black people trying to get the right to vote. It's just nothing but chaos and violence. So that's why in 1951, Paul Robeson and William L. Patterson, who's the executive of the Civil Rights Congress, submitted a 225-page petition to the United Nations Assembly, General Assembly, titled "We Charge Genocide, the Crime of Government Against the Negro." And Patterson and his team used what was then new, the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly December 19, 1948. And they used that, the Convention on Genocide, to make the case that Black people were victims of genocide. Now, in documented racial violence after the war, at least 153 killings of Black people, and presented a legal argument that identified systematic violence and terrorism as part of state policy to crush movements of opposition and maintain the racial and class status quo. Now, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, he had a fit. He insisted, first, it didn't apply to Negroes. He accused the authors of sabotaging the U.S. Senate's ratification of the convention and, quote, diverting attention away from the crimes of genocide perpetrated in the Soviet Union. Now, in fairness to Lemkin, he changes his mind, by the way. And most people don't like that. They like to attack him. But he actually thought about it, and he said, you know what? Black people do fall under the category of genocide. And then he actually worked on Algeria as well. So in fairness to Lemkin, he actually came around. But my point is, anti-communism, his own anti-communism, made it hard for him to actually see the argument that they're making. But it's not as if Black people didn't know this. That is to say, this is an article, October 21st, 1950, from the Amsterdam News, headline, UN Law May Be Hard on Dixie, which argued that, quote, "the lynching of Negroes in the United States and race destruction in the Union of South Africa would be considered crimes of genocide." So they didn't need recharge genocide to know that. All the Black people understood that, certainly the journalists. U.S. senators understood this as well. They understood it all too well, which explains why the U.S. did not ratify the Genocide Convention until 1988. So like previous petitions, Patterson draws a direct line between domestic genocide and colonial war. Of course, the story of Black anti-fascism and resistance to genocide doesn't end here. From 64 to 72, the U.S. had more urban insurrections than any other Western country in the world. In other words, war was taking place. It's not a stretch to say the United States was the epicenter of urban warfare in the Western Hemisphere. And it was also the epicenter of counterinsurgency tactics in the hemisphere. Police and the National Guard turned black neighborhoods into war zones, arresting tens of thousands of people, employing tanks, machine guns, and tear gas to pacify the community. I don't know why anyone doesn't realize that war was taking place in the United States on U.S. soil. But it just was in the ghettos. Like, that's war. So, therefore, some of these people involved in rebellions sparked by these incidents of state violence named the repression fascist, and they saw themselves as anti-fascist, and hence some of the use of fascism here. So consider Revolutionary Action Movement, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the Community Alert Patrol, Black Liberation Army, the Brown Berets, the National Committee to Combat Fascism, the Black Liberation Front, all of them use the term fascism to refer to state violence and to the way the state treated black people. State and vigilante violence, of course, actually escalates in the 70s and 80s with the defeat of the insurgency of 1968. I just want to say the black radical tradition against fascism and genocide continues to this day, and so does the deep commitment to internationalism, be it Haiti, Congo, Sudan, and of course, Palestine. I want to end by returning to the present and to say a few words about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, something that our university administrators all over the country has chosen to endorse. In spite of the fact that the current administration in the White House attacks any criticism of Israel as cover to shield its own anti-Semitism. That's what they do. So we witness a dress rehearsal of Trump's policies when the House Committee on Education and Workforce, led by Virginia Fox and Elise Stefanik, held McCarthy-like hearings charging, quote-unquote, liberal university presidents with allowing their institutions to become hotbeds of anti-Semitism. Now, if anti-Semitism was the primary concern, they would have investigated the white nationalists and Nazis who attacked our students on my campus at UCLA for their Palestine Solidarity encampment, right? But none of them were investigated. If anti-Semitism was a concern, the January 6th insurrectionists, right, would be investigated. I mean, you had people wearing sweatshirts that said Camp Auschwitz. You had people wearing T-shirts that said 6MWE, 6 million weren't enough. And they all got exonerated, right? Christian Zionists and white Christian nationalists make up a significant part of the MAGA base. They claim to be defenders of Israel, and the Israeli right embraces figures like Reverend John Hagee, head of Christians United for Israel. And this is the same minister who once preached that God sent Hitler to hunt the Jews and the Jews will suffer for eternity in hell. I'm so stupid. I think that's anti-Semitic, but what the hell? Now, these are the folks who preach the new dispensation that Jesus will rise from the dead, return the Holy Land to the Christians. So whereas Israeli leadership is chomping at the bit to take all of Palestine, you know, Eretz Israel, Christian Zionists are waiting for Judgment Day so that they could take all of Israel from the Jews. In this scenario, financing Israeli aggression and shielding it from international law does not make Jews safer, especially those Jews who are anti-Zionist or just critical of Israeli policies. And the Trump administration will continue to stay silent on right-wing anti-Semitism while punishing all supporters of Palestinian liberation. In other words, and follow me here, the current regime demands fealty to Israel, but not to the Jewish community. Jews are still suspect, and Christianity is perceived to be under threat. And if you don't believe me, read Executive Order 14202, Eradicating Anti-Christian Bias. Just read it. Think about what it means, right, for Zionist organizations like B'Tahr to turn in foreign national students critical of Israel for deportation. Here, I can't help but think about all those Israeli men who show up at our protests, who heckle and disrupt our protests, and they're wrapped in American flags. Sometimes it's like the flag of Israel and the United States, but mostly American flags. and they're standing there calling for more deportations, when the same government they're working for just pardoned proponents of the Great Replacement Theory. Think about that. They delude themselves into thinking they're safe, right? And of course, none of this is new. And by the way, they're coming for all of us. And I will say publicly right here, I'm being filmed, if they come after anybody, including Zionist Jews, you don't think I'm gonna defend them? Of course I am. Because this is about a war against people that's deeply anti-Semitic, and they don't even realize it. It's like they're cutting their own throat. So, of course, none of this is new. Those of us who have been fighting for Palestine's freedom are familiar with Canary Mission. They got a terrible picture of me out there. posting names of people, it falsely accuses of anti-Semitism, or the practice of doxing, which is illegal, or the ADL's long history of spying on progressive organizations or groups such as Israel on Campus Coalition with a $9 million budget to collect information on students and faculty engaged in Palestine justice work and feed that information directly to Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Now, rather than investigate these organizations for libel or invasion of privacy, or violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, the state incorporates them into the police apparatus. It's like the deputizing of white men, the deputizing of those Zionist Jews who think somehow that the state that's against them is for them because they do the dirty work of defending a right-wing regime in Israel and defending the occupation, defending war and genocide. So many of us are panicking over Colombia's appeasement. By the way, you know, when UCLA's appeasement appears, it's going to make Colombia look like the resistance. It's coming. But what they forget, though, is that at least since 2009, American colleges and universities have been relentless in their suppression of Palestine advocacy. They didn't need the Trump administration. Before the encampments, university administrators have been predisposed to arrest student protesters, initiate disciplinary hearings, and rarely have university presidents elected to negotiate seriously in a way that would consider divesting from companies that fuel and finance war and occupation of Palestine. No college or university has suffered financially from divesting from apartheid South Africa, from private prisons, or the fossil fuel companies. Show me one university that went out of business because they divested. Just show me one. You can't. Because I'm right. So, you know, histories of anti-apartheid, ironically, right, the anti-apartheid protests on campuses at Yale, Princeton, Cornell, UCLA, are used to advertise their commitment to social justice. I'm sure it happens here, too. The truth is, they are worried about the symbolic costs of bucking the Palestine exception and the real costs in terms of potential loss of donors. That's the thing they're concerned about. Calls for divestment or even a permanent ceasefire elicited absurd charges of being pro-Hamas. Seriously? Anti-Semitic. Proponents of Israel's annihilation. Trustees and donors have gone further, demanding even harsher punishments for student protesters and conspiring with the corporate and legal world to deny them future employment, which is also illegal. And university leaders have chosen to cower before such threats rather than stand up for the rights, well-being, and safety of all their tuition-paying students. And the last point is really crucial because it explains why our universities have become police states. UCLA spent $12 million in spring alone just to suppress protests. The UC system spent on a whole $29 million. My point is that, you know, it's important to name the ongoing attack on critical thought by way of the Palestine exception, waged by our own liberal administrations, because it is so easy to blame the right. The lessons here, for me at least, and this is a kind of broader lesson altogether, is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. And for me, it means to go to the root, to understand that when we keep repeating Martin Niemöller's words, first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I'm not a socialist and so forth and so on. You know, it's kind of disingenuous because we have to find a way to live the implications of the warning. Not just repeat them maybe once in a while when things get hard. That is to say, we need to always stand in solidarity and fight for others as if our lives depended on it, right? And that means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance, not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, right? All living things. It means seeing every racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic act, every brutal act of state violence, every deportation, every denial of health care for the most vulnerable and so forth, as an attack on all of us, as an attack on the class. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere. And we don't have to ask for something in return, right? That's what solidarity means. And we have to remember, and again, this is the Black radical tradition, that some of the most dynamic movements emerge at the height of racist reaction, economic crisis, war, and militarism. These movements were fueled not by false optimism, but by a deep understanding of the reality that they face. The Black radical tradition understood that the only way to ensure our survival, right, our very survival, was to envision a radically different future for all of us, everyone in it, even the people we don't like, and fight to bring it into existence. Thank you.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. He spoke in April 2025 at UMass Amherst. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Heather Cox Richardson, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, Tariq Ali, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sat Jolly and the Media Education Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, Blue Monk. Thank you.
I'm Jimmy Moss.
And I'm Juan Garcia.
And we are back in 2025 for Season 2 of Vamos Verde.
We give you an inside look at Austin's Major League Soccer team, Austin FC.
And we also give you a deeper look into the art and culture surrounding the team and the city of Austin.
The players.
The artists.
People you know.
People you need to know.
Listen to Vamos Verde every other week from KUT Radio, part of the NPR network. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Back in, I'll call it 2015, 2016, now just kind of started seeing the shift towards, you know, fashion within sports, right? Whether it was what are guys wearing on draft night or what's Russell Westbrook wearing walking into the game this week, you know, what's Cam Newton wearing walking into the game. So I just started to see that blend, and I just had the thought, like, you know, man, you know, this could, you know, what if there was a way to represent your favorite team or your alma mater, your college, with a suit?
Carlton Dixon, former star high school and collegiate basketball player, high school coach and athletic director, and founder and CEO reveals suits. In 2018, former high school athletic director and basketball coach and University of Texas at Austin alum Dixon launched Reveal Suits. Reveal Suits specializes in crafting high-quality custom suits and blazers for both men and women. Today, Reveal Suits has licenses for 90 colleges and is generating over $1 million a year. The company has landed apparel contracts to suit up inductees for the College Football Hall of Fame, National Soccer Hall of Fame, and members of the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame for bowl games, the NFL Alumni Association, HBCU All-Stars, the Ivy League, and the Big 12 Conference. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Reveal Suits with founder and CEO Carlton Dixon, In Black America.
I was a student of, of course, basketball, but I was also, I was wanting to know and get a better insight into just kind of the madness behind what was on the court. I wanted to, I was interested in the marketing, and I was interested in how they would reach out to the local elementary schools and get them involved. I was just wanting to know a lot about just the machine that was Texas Athletic. And I think I knew at that time that I was going to end up being, I actually was more focused on becoming an athletic director than I was a coach, but fortunately, I ended up accomplishing both.
As a national merit finalist and basketball All-American, Carlton Dixon was enjoying a successful career as a high school basketball coach, then as an athletic director, when the idea for Reveal Suits came upon him. While watching the NBA or NFL draft, Dixon would see athletes wearing creative suits that often represented their colleges, so he thought he would distribute personalized suits with officially licensed lining before the big-name apparel companies could beat him to it. Founded in 2018, Reveal Suits' first big break came when they landed a contract to make Reveal Suits for Florida State and Baylor football teams. Dixon was a 3-year letterman with the University of Texas men basketball program, and in 1998, he earned a bachelor's degree in speech communication from the university. Reveal Suits is a minority and veteran-owned company based in Dallas, Texas, and the company is now one of the growing brands in the fashion industry. Recently, In Black America spoke with founder and CEO Carlton Dixon.
Raised in Dallas. I was born in Chicago, stayed there for about 6 years, and then moved to Dallas back in, 81 now. I'm dating myself, but grew up in Dallas, in the South Dallas area, inner city area of Dallas, just all kind of great life experiences there. I had the pleasure of winning a state championship at Lincoln High School. Should have had two of them, but that's a whole nother story. And then went on to play at University of Texas and got my degree in communications. And just kind of shaped me for the rest of what was to come.
I heard that. Brothers and sisters?
Yes, sir. Well, the short story is that it's me and my sister Carlisa Dixon, who has emerged as just one of the top high school coaches in the state of Texas. She's just a phenomenal girls basketball coach. And then the long, long story is that I'm one of 13 when you include all of my father's children. So, you know, heavy, you know, back in Chicago, a lot of them back in Chicago still. And we all have great relationships. So, part of a loving family on both sides.
I heard that. When did you develop that love for basketball?
Oh, man. I'm going to take you back to the fourth grade, the Oak Cliff Lakers, man, playing in the YMCA over at the Keys YMCA. You know, got together with some school friends, and, you know, we just began to play and practice every week. And then I began to play for our elementary school's team as well, and just realized that, you know, I might have had a little something. And, you know, middle school just began to further develop my game and going to camps. I was at the SMU basketball camp every summer under Billy Tubbs, John Shoemate, both have passed on, but just some incredible teachers of the game. And, you know, by the ninth grade, I was just kind of like, I was starting on varsity, and I was just like, okay, I think we may have something here. And just kept being a student of the game and learning the game, and the rest is history. Just fortunate to have a great career after that.
I heard that. What did you find special about those state championship teams?
Man, you know, it's just something about doing it with the guys that were from the neighborhood, right? You know, just, you know, we were a bunch of inner city kids. You know, everybody's got, you know, their respective challenges and setbacks, you know, as a product of being in the inner city. But, man, when it came to that basketball court, man, we had one common goal. We were 15 brothers that were just determined to accomplish that goal. And I think, you know, being where we were from South Dallas, having to overcome, you know, things that, you know, most other players from other schools didn't have to overcome. And so by us being able to do that and, you know, keep the focus, you know, keep on top of our grades as well, just special, man, just real special. And you know, those are my brothers even to this day.
Was UT the only one that came calling?
No, I was, I was fortunate to get just some incredible home visits. You know, I had, of course, Coach Penders, who ended up, winning me over. But, you know, he was competing with Lute Olson from Arizona, and Stu Jackson when he was coaching at Wisconsin at the time, Gene Cady at Purdue. So it actually came down to Purdue and Texas. And I was a real big fan of Coach Cady's, you know, that Big Ten style. I just think at the end of the day, you know, Texas was run and gun. They were on TV, and it was close to home to where friends and family could still come and watch me play. And, no regrets at all. Like I said, it was, you know, I had four or five great final choices. Fortunate to, you know, I still know where my box of letters is at my mom's house. So I was just fortunate to get letters from all over the country, man. But, UT ended up being a special place, and zero regrets.
Now, was it about UT that helped you make that transition into athletics as one, as a coach, and then as an athletic director?
Yeah, man, I used to be, I was a student of, you know, of course, basketball, but I was also, you know, I was wanting to know and get a better insight into just kind of the madness behind what was on the court. I wanted to, you know, I was interested in the marketing, and I was interested in how they would reach out to the local elementary schools and get them involved. You know, I was just wanting to know a lot about just the machine that was Texas Athletic. And I think I knew at that time that I was going to end up being, you know, I actually was more focused on becoming an athletic director than I was a coach, but fortunately I ended up accomplishing both. And I just remember, you know, just being there and, you know, walking into, you know, whether it was Kurt Flood's office at the time or the Lost Dogs at the time. Just wanted to know just what was making this big machine turn. And, you know, I was just really interested in the behind the scenes stuff, and just hoped one day that I would be able to do that at some level. And I ended up being able to accomplish that at the high school level. So, you know, I was just grateful that, you know, that nobody ever kicked me out of their office when I wanted to learn a little bit more.
Now, you was at North Dallas High School as the coaching athletic director. Was that your choice or Dallas Independent School District's choice?
When I saw the vacancy, and I remember at the time, it was the summer of 2011, I saw the vacancy, and I knew that was my choice. I mean, that was my, you know, that was my time. North Dallas, you know, being a long time, you know, DISD kid, you know, North Dallas was at school. It was the easy victory, right? You know, they had their challenges from an overall athletic standpoint. They weren't really known for, you know, basketball, football, baseball. They had a strong, you know, tennis and soccer program, but, you know, it was that school that wasn't high on the radar from an athletic standpoint. And so I actually embraced that, and I wanted to go in and put my stamp on it, you know, from a culture standpoint. You know, yeah, we may not have the track record of the best basketball, the best football, but why can't we change that? And so I was, you know, I was hyped up to get the job to change the culture. And I believe in my 3 years that culture was changed. And I'm still a fan of what they're doing over there now, still building, you know, and perhaps they won't reach from the basketball football standpoint, maybe they won't reach the heights of a Lincoln or a South Oak Cliff or a Kimball, but I was very, very proud of what we were able to accomplish, and just to see, you know, how their mindset changed, and they kind of adopted my mentality of why not us, right? And it was just good to see those small victories over there that we were able to accomplish. And like I said, I'm still a big fan, big supporter of what they have going on there.
Being a former athlete yourself and the students knowing that, what were some of the challenges that you had to overcome, and why was it important for you to kind of nurture these young men?
I think that, you know, from my basketball team standpoint, they saw how much of a competitor I still was. Like at that time, you know, I was still mid-30s, man. So, you know, still, I was still, you know, cocking that thing behind my head at that, you know, during that time. And so I say that to say that I think they saw how, whether it was, you know, me coaching them or me playing against them, I think they saw what my mentality was. And I was just like, hey, if you're on the other side, whoever you are, I'm still trying to kill you. And I think that they saw that repeatedly in me, to where they were like, oh shoot, we need to get down like that. And I think it helped, you know, and I, you know, still hear from a few, you know, of them to this day, you know, just kind of thanking me for that mindset that we were able to instill. And like I said, before I got there, it was just, you know, hey, we're just doing this just to do it. But I was just like, oh, anytime I step on this floor, we're not doing it just to do it. We're doing it to win. And I could slowly start seeing that attitude being developed. And, you know, I was, like I said, I think in 3 years, I was able to empower those young men. And then as an athletic director, even the young women on the women's sports, just able to empower them to think the same way. And hey, let's change the culture here. And so, you know, that was a very rewarding experience for me, you know, knowing, you know, for the most part that we, you know, there weren't going to be any state championships. There weren't going to be any, you know, huge, huge accolades, but to see the culture that changed, the way the culture changed, the way that we were able to instill confidence in those young men and women, man, that was huge for me. So definitely thankful for that.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Carlton Dixon, former high school and college basketball star, coach, athletic director, and founder and CEO of Real Suits. Mr. Dixon, when did you come up with the idea of apparel? Obviously, you was having a successful career in high school as a coach and athletic director, and you pivoted. Why so?
Yeah, man, back in, I'll call it 2015, 2016 now, just kind of started seeing the shift towards, you know, fashion within sports, right? Whether it was what are guys wearing on draft night or what's Russell Westbrook wearing walking into the game this week, you know, what's Cam Newton wearing walking into the game? So I just started to see that blend, and I just had the thought, like, you know, man, you know, this could, you know, what if there was a way to represent your favorite team or your alma mater, your college, with a suit, you know, all of the Longhorn stuff that I had in my closet at the time, a polo, a sweatshirt, a cap, a t-shirt. And I was like, man, I don't have a suit. Like, this would be next level. And so it really just the whole vision just began from I wonder if this is even possible. And so I just started playing with some different just kind of visions in my head. And I can't, you know, I landed at the inner lining concept, and I started, you know, just kind of putting it out there to, you know, a few people who I kind of trusted who were, you know, already in the collegiate sports space. And just kind of getting their feedback, like, hey, give me honest feedback on this. Would you buy this for your players? Would you rep this as a coach? Would you, you know, just kind of what, you know, any forms of those questions. And I just got nothing but positive feedback. And, you know, the process clearly is not as cut and dry and as simple as I'm, you know, making it out to be, perhaps. It was a, you know, once I decided to go for it, it was a good 15-month process from a licensing standpoint, from the standpoint of just learning about the industry, getting my supply chain together. You know, I'm a communications major, man. I didn't go to school for anything, you know, like this. And so it was a big learning curve for me if this was what I wanted to explore. And you know, made the decision to, you know, my wife and I, we were just like, hey, let's go for it. And, you know, and that's exactly what we did. And so it was really just trying to figure out if this product, this new product, yeah, I wasn't creating a new garment. The suit's been around for 300 years, but putting that different spin on it from a college license standpoint, that's what I was determined to do. And, you know, so far, so good.
Now, you came up with the idea for the inner lining. You know, we see patches on the outside, on the pocket. So when you came up with that particular thought, how did you envision the inner lining looking like?
Yeah, it was, I knew that was the direction I wanted to go. You know, from an inner lining standpoint, number one, I thought it was a very subtle way to accomplish what I was trying to accomplish. I think, you know, I had the thought of, you know, okay, do I put this Longhorn on the outside? Nah, that may limit, you know, where I can wear the suit, and, you know, probably can't walk up in just a general, you know, kind of setting.
You couldn't walk on A&M campus with that.
Yeah.
Okay,
right?
I got you.
And so, you know, it was just one of those things. I was just like, okay, this inside route, I think is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how can I make this happen? And so then it was just a, it was just a matter of research and development. And, you know, I probably went through 20 different suppliers to get some samples made. And, you know, I found one that found, you know, that checked all of the boxes I was looking for, because I wanted to know that they could do, you know, both male and female suits. I wanted to know that their turnaround time was good. It was just quite a few boxes that I wanted to be checked. And we ended up finding that supplier, and everything was able to come together. And within a few weeks after I officially put it out there, I had Florida State football and Baylor football ready to buy for their entire teams. And so once that happened, I was like, okay, this is game on now. No looking back.
Now, when you got those initial contracts, was it somewhat overwhelming? You said, now, you know, it's show and tell. Now I got to produce.
Yes, it was. And if, you know, if anybody that was in that position said otherwise, I'd have to look at them upside down a little bit.
I know that's right.
It was, you know, that's just, you know, it's the show and tell. It's the pressure. Thankfully, I've been able to draw, you know, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I draw from the experience that I had in big games, right? In eight title games, in March Madness games, you know, it's game on now. And so you got to rise to the occasion. And so I took that very seriously. I made sure that things were, you know, done properly, in place, that this whole experience that we were about to give these teams is going to be very efficient. Mm-hmm. And I just took that very seriously. And thankfully it was able to, you know, it was all able to come together really good.
Now, what is it? Is it a standard turnaround time, or it depends on how many garments you need to produce?
Depends on the number. I mean, okay. But my turnaround times are good, even from an individual suit standpoint, maybe up until about, call it 25 suits, 25 garments. My turnaround time is right at about 3 weeks. Now, if we're doing a big football team, typically that goes to about 4 to 5 weeks, which is still, you know, which is still very well received, still very good, you know, within the industry, within the market. And so we're very proud and happy about the turnaround times and where we've gotten those to.
Now, when the teams come to you, either be collegiate or professional, obviously the licensing is probably part of that agreement. But talk to us about that process of, one, a professional sports franchises obtaining licenses, and also the other collegiate schools, that process that you have to go through to, you know, to get they okay to use their logos.
Yeah, so the collegiate space, you know, you got to go through the NCAA for that. You know, they have a licensing entity you go through, and, you know, there's all kind of due diligence that they do about your company, your brand. Want to make sure that you're in compliance with all the colors and knowing the do's and don'ts from a trademark standpoint. You know, they're going to look at your supply chain, make sure that everything's on the up and up there. And like I said, it was a good year plus process. And so they're going to do a deep dive of your company, make sure that at the end of the day, making sure that they can trust us as the company to deliver these goods that represents the brands that they govern. You know, there's been a lot of counterfeit stuff that's gone out over the years. And so they're going to make sure that you're legit. And that's why it takes the length of time that it did. But I was dead set on seeing the process through. And yeah, we made it on the other side.
Talk to us about the University of Texas program that they initiated for, one, alumnus, but also having you part of a program for minorities to participate in doing business with the UT.
Yeah, you know, of course, just coming back home and to be able to have, you know, the alma mater support the brand. We became an official partner back in 2020, which kind of helped set the tone for a lot of the business that we have there now. You know, a lot of the faces, you know, some of the faces that were there when I was playing, you know, who are still there, okay. played big roles in, you know, helping us get across the finish line from a you know, from a business standpoint, you know, there's still the licensing piece that you got to go through, and nobody can escape that. But I think that they were very excited to, you know, get Reveal on board. You know, the story just was a great story. Former student athlete, former player, guy who graduated in 4 years. Now he's coming back to provide our current student athletes from all sports with this professional attire that also represents the Longhorn brand. So I'm very grateful to, you know, Chris Plonsky, you know, Coach Conrad, even in her retirement, just being an advocate for the brand, even back when Shaka was there, just really been fortunate to have some great support from some of those leaders like that. And I'm sure it's a few other names that I'm, you know, failing to remember, but just some really good support once we were ready to activate our presence there on the 40 acres.
I found it interesting when I was doing research for this conversation. Obviously, you're familiar with Orange, but when the NBA came calling the Hall of Fame, you all had to research a certain type of orange. And what was that like when you got that phone call and say, we want you to outfit our inductees?
Man, the craziest day that I can remember. I remember almost what I had on. I remember the time of day.
Right.
I was sitting in my office, and just to see Naismith Hall of Fame even appear on my caller ID, just thought it was a joke. And to hear that, number one, that they have just been watching us, watching our activity on social media, on LinkedIn, that was just phenomenal to hear. And then for them to tell us that they wanted us, not were we interested, but to hear them tell us that they wanted us and they had been advised to come and find us, you know, as a former Hooper, that was just, I mean, that was incredible to me, you know, just knowing that this sport that I love and live, breathe, eat, sleep, that the highest of the highest in that sport was, you know, a fan of ours and wanted to align themselves with us, man. It was just, that was a surreal day. I remember calling my wife as soon as I got off the phone, and I was just like, you won't believe what just happened. And, you know, I mean, of course, it took some business negotiations to make everything work. But to see how they wanted us and wanted to integrate Reveal into what they were doing and how they wanted to elevate the Naismith Hall of Fame brand, you know, just couldn't be more grateful. I mean, Jerry Colangelo and, you know, all those, I mean, it's just surreal. Every year we do it, and we're coming up on our fifth year right now, and every year we're there, it still just seems unreal. And you know, for me, it's just one of the biggest validations of, you know, man, we may really be doing something. Just one of the biggest validations that Reveal has ever had.
Carlton Dixon, founder and CEO of Reveal Suits. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again, for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters helping to bring diversity to the airwaves. You can find more shows like In Black America in the NPR Network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr.
I'm Jimmy Moss.
And I'm Juan Garcia.
And we are back in 2025 for Season 2 of Vamos Verde.
We give you an inside look at Austin's Major League Soccer team, Austin FC.
And we also give you a deeper look into the art and culture surrounding the team and the city of Austin.
The players.
The artists.
People you know.
People you need to know.
Listen to Vamos Verde every other week from KUT Radio, part of the NPR network.
The University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
You know, just knowing that this sport that I love and live, breathe, eat, sleep, that the highest of the highest in that sport was, you know, a fan of ours and wanted to align themselves with us, man. It was just, that was a surreal day. I remember calling my wife as soon as I got off the phone, and I was just like, you won't believe what just happened. And, you know, I mean, of course, it took some business negotiations to make everything work. But to see how they wanted us and wanted to integrate Reveal into what they were doing and how they wanted to elevate the Naismith Hall of Fame brand, you know, just couldn't be more grateful. I mean, Jerry Colangelo and, you know, all those. I mean, it's just surreal. Every year we do it. And we're coming up on our fifth year right now. And every year we're there, it still just seems unreal.
Carlton Dixon, former Star High School and collegiate basketball player, high school coach and athletic director, and founder and CEO of Reveal Suits.